Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books Network, New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Elena McGrath, a host of the channel. With us today is Jamie Heilman, Associate Professor of History at the University of Alberta. She is co-author with Manuel Yamoja Mitma of the book Now Peru is Mine, a testimonial biography of a campesino activist whose life and work spanned much of the 20th century. This book was published by Duke in 2016. Jamie Heilman, thank you so much for being here and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
So I would like you to start by telling us a little bit about yourself, where you come from, and how you came to write this book.
Sure. So I'm from Alberta, and I have the amazing fortune of working at, in the same place that I grew up and did my undergraduate degree. And so when I started university, I was really interested in Chinese history, but I didn't speak Mandarin, but I was learning Spanish. And I, in my first Latin American history class, came across, learned about the Shining Path Rebellion in Peru, Maoist insurrection. And so that led to, eventually, to graduate school and my first book, my dissertation and first book, which was on essentially a prehistory of the Shining Path in Peru. And so that's sort of where my that's sort of led up to coming across Yamoja and beginning the project that ultimately became this book.
That's great. And so at what point did you sort of see Yamoja as a figure that you needed to spend more time with or that you wanted others to spend more time with?
Sure. So it's sort of very clear. My first meeting with this amazing man actually happened in the archive, and it was not with him in person, but rather with a letter he'd written in, I think, 1965. So I was just going through documents about Ayacucho Peru's political history in the 1960s, these sort of local petitions and documents, and I found just this petition that the language of it just blew me away. It was... the phrase that he kept repeating in this letter, this petition, was enough is enough. Like, campesinos have suffered, people have suffered in Peru since the time the Spaniards arrived. And I was just like, who is this person? And so the more I researched, I kept coming across references to Manuel Yamoja. I kept coming across references to this dangerous communist in our midst. Sort of letters written mostly in the 50s and 60s, a few into the early 1970s. And then just in chatting with some Peruvian friends of mine, this was the time of when Peru was in the midst of doing the work of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And so I had some friends who were actually working for the Truth Commission. And one of those friends, a guy named Ivan Caro, who's also a historian, Peruvian, we were just chatting one day, and I mentioned Manuel Yamoja, finding him in the archive, and asked Ivan if he knew anything about Yamoja. And he's like, of course I do. I interviewed him. I was like, what? And so it turned out that Ivan had done an interview with Yamoja for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Ivan also told me when I asked that Yamoja had died. And so while I was able to get my hands on the transcript of the Truth and Reconciliation or the CBR's interview with Yamoja, I just assumed that Yamoja was dead. And a number of other people told me the same thing, that he had died shortly after his interview with the CBR, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. in 2002. And so I was like, ugh, what a disappointment. But I didn't really ask any more questions. But I continued to collect, sort of making a mental note of or writing down, you know, when I came across a reference to Yamaha in the archives or in periodicals. There was a really rich leftist periodicals, newspapers in Peru, and Yamaha would write frequently. And so I always sort of made notes of where those things were, thinking that, you know, even though he was dead, possibly I could write something about him, maybe a book, maybe an article, something. And the way it turned out was that I, in filling out my webpage for my university, just like who I am and what future projects I might have, I just happened to list a biography of Manuel Yamaha as something that I might pursue. And then in a sort of short turn of a really eventful week, I received two emails. One was from Yamaha's daughter, Maria, saying, "This is my dad. Who are you?" And another from another friend of mine, a guy named Ricardo Caro, with whom I talked about Yamaha a lot. And we'd always sort of lamented the fact that he was dead and that we weren't able to talk to him. And Ricardo sent me this email saying, "He's alive. I just came back from visiting with him." And so things got rolling very quickly from there. That was 2010. So 8 years after assuming that he was dead, it turned out he was very much alive. And that really got this new project going in a very quick way.
That's so fantastic. And what a fortuitous week you had.
So whenever I talk to students or people about the book, I'm always like, I didn't inquire further. If I have one takeaway lesson, it's inquire further. Like, don't take anything for granted. Incorrect information.
That's fantastic. So one of the beautiful things about the book is how it allows English language readers to really see Yamaha's voice, mm-hmm. And to read his words and to kind of get the power of his style of communication. And so at what point did you decide you were going to co-write a book, or presumably after you realized he was alive and that was a possibility, but what made this particular style of book appealing to you?
So, I mean, the thing about Yamaha that's, you know, for those who had the, you know, the amazing fortune to meet him, this man was just a consummate storyteller. I've never had easier oral history interviews in my life, because basically all I had to do was ask one question and hit record, and he would talk for hours with, you know, you've read the book, these incredibly rich, often hilarious stories, quite touching stories, but very much, he already had a book written in his head. And he had tried a few times to get it down on paper. But, you know, life is hard. And when you just have a typewriter, when you he'd lost much of his ability to see, sort of just the circumstances of life had never really allowed him to put down all of these stories on paper. And so very quickly after we had our first conversation, it was very clear that there was enough material there for a book, and that it should be a book that would really, you know, have his voice at the forefront, precisely because his stories and his history was so amazing, and the way that he crafted it with these, you know, basically these rich anecdotes was so, you know, gripping. That said, the process of figuring out how to best present this to a readership was not actually obvious from the start. I had started out thinking that the best way to showcase his story and to share it with the world was by doing a really unmediated text, one in which my interventions as an author were quite limited. And so I experimented with a format that really kept my questions in and relegated introductions and historical context to postscripts at the end of chapters or lengthy footnotes. And it was the sort of really what I thought was like cutting edge presentation, really modeled along the lines of what my advisor, perhaps your advisor, Florencia Mallon, had done with her book with Isolde Reuke, which kept the questions in and was really quite transparent. Something Lynn Steven had done with the book. Oh, I can't remember the narrator's name. I'm sorry. Hear My Voice, or Maria Tula, I think her name is. Maria Tula.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So I did this whole first draft of this book in this way, using these amazing stories. And I had all this archival stuff too, which I wanted in there to help their reader along. But I didn't want to sort of take away from Yumoho's voice. And so I wrote a draft of it, and I shared it with my closest intellectual colleague, who's also my best friend, a historian named Gladys McCormick. We went to school together, and she's very much my sounding board, as I am hers for writing. And, she's very knowledgeable about 20th century Peruvian history. She's a Mexicanist. And she read it and she said, Jamie, this book is totally inaccessible. If your goal is to present Yumoho's story to the world as he very much wanted it presented, she's like, you need a format that helps your readers along more. She's like, this is too weird. It's too experimental. And ultimately, it's too inaccessible. And that was hard to hear, having a whole first draft of the book. And my plan was to take a sort of a polished first draft back to Yumoho to share. That was hard to hear, but she was completely right. And so I ended up taking a step back, and, thinking maybe a more traditional biography would be appropriate, but I knew that wasn't right either, because, Yumoho wanted his stories out. I wanted his stories out. And so basically what I quickly settled upon was sort of the compromise format of this book, a book that very much puts his life stories front and center, but that is also somewhat more traditional in that my questions don't appear. I very much contextualize each of his anecdotes historically. I weave in what was happening in Peru at this time to essentially provide readers who might not be super familiar with 20th century Peruvian history the kind of help that they would need, so that they wouldn't be distracted by what they didn't know. And therefore, this more traditional format was a way of essentially allowing Yumoho's stories to speak for themselves by having my context essentially amplify it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And as someone who's assigned this book to students this past spring term, I have to say, I think you do a very impressive job of weaving in a lot of different history. The Shining Path is not an easy thing to teach, as I'm sure you know. Yumoho's particular place within the 20th century is a complicated thing. But I think the way that you have structured the book really does allow a number of different complex issues to be fairly accessible to the reader. I think it's a remarkable example of that. So one of the things that I did want to talk to you about is the uses that you think this book has pedagogically, because I know that my students responded really, they were really excited by the concept of organic intellectual. This was sort of their introduction to that concept, although it's obviously not one that you have invented. But I also was struck by the idea that Yumoho is someone that Peruvian students would seek out as a sort of, as a person to interview as part of their education and trying to understand what had happened in the 20th century. So did he see himself as participating in a kind of pedagogical process with this book?
I'm pausing here because I'm thinking. He would see it. He saw it less as sort of pedagogy for the limited university world. I mean, that's a huge world, but he was thinking broader. I mean, he wanted people everywhere, in universities, but also outside universities, to understand what had happened in Peru since the time of the Inca, basically, and certainly with the Spanish conquest. And so, when I first proposed writing a book with him, I thought it was going to be like a complex negotiation, but he was just like, right away, he was like, absolutely, let's do it. Like, let's get to it. Like, we have no time to waste. Like, and we then proceeded to record like a 5-hour interview. And so he very much was keen to get his story out to anyone and everyone who would listen. Certainly a high point, or sort of something he was very proud of in his life. I mean, he had a lot to be proud of, but he was certainly, you know, very proud with good reason of all the opportunities he had had to share his intellectual work with students of all sorts, whether that was university students who would make the trip from the university in essentially the Ayacucho city, Huamanga, all the way to his home in a place called Concepcion, but also those times that he was able to speak in front of university students in Lima. I think the high point of his life as an activist, as a teacher, came in 1965. He was invited on a set of international trips. So he went to Cuba and spoke at this international gathering of leftists. He went to China and learned a lot. He went to the Soviet Union. And really sort of he saw these as opportunities to tell the world about what was going on in Peru. And so as we spoke about the book, he very much talked about the essential task we had, he and I had, of getting his story down and getting it out, and getting it out as quickly as possible. He had a very urgent timeline for this book. He was very aware that he was old. He was already in his 90s. He was very aware that, that he had a limited number of years left in life. He'd already suffered one stroke several years before. And he was acutely conscious of the fact that he was losing his memory. He would get so heartbreakingly frustrated at himself during his interviews. I mean, he told these stories that, had this incredible, depth of information, just the most incredible interviews I've ever had the privilege of listening to and conducting, just with the depth and the detail. But he would get frustrated when he couldn't remember a year, couldn't remember a person's name. Sometimes he joked that he thought he'd been subjected to spells, to witchcraft, that something had, made him lose his memory. And so he just had this real desire to get things done as quickly as possible. And so in that, I think he wanted to share his story as a teacher, but thinking of students both inside and outside the university.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So one of the things that struck me as I was reading it, and this comes across in the title and in the very beginning of the book, is just the scope of Yomoja's ambition as saying, now Peru is mine, I will someday be president, these sorts of things. And I was wondering if you chose the title, or if that was something that he collaborated on, or how you came to sort of foreground that.
I mean,
or if it's just irrepressible.
I did choose the title. I mean, to me, it was just so sort of classic of the kind of statements he would make, and sort of the story behind that, now Peru is mine, is that he says that as a very young man when he sort of tricked the military into conscripting him, and he rubs his hands together gleefully thinking that the path to the presidency is his. And it's kind of funny because as I wrote a first draft and shared it with some colleagues, a few said to me, Gladys and another colleague said, he sounds kind of arrogant. And I thought, oh my God, that is so not him. I mean, he was the most, he was very short. He was very easygoing. His daughter, Maria, described him as sort of very humble, actually kind of quiet. And so, on the one end, you have this guy saying, now Peru is mine, and, comparing himself at times to Jesus. And the way that I had to work to help the reader understand that he wasn't just some, like, raging egotist, was instead to sort of show that he's somebody who Peruvians had essentially forgotten about. One of the most revealing moments for me in terms of situating him and sort of the tragedy of his own life and the tragedy of the 20th century Peruvian left was I was doing an interview with some leaders of the Peruvian Peasant Confederation, which Yamoja had been only the second leader of in the Confederation's entire history. It had essentially founded in the 1920s, and then it was defunct for many years. And he was really instrumental in bringing it back to life. So, I mean, without him, this organization would not have become the sort of huge organization it remains to this day in Peru. And so I was having this interview with these leaders of the CCP, the Peruvian Peasant Confederation, and I explained what I was doing with this project. And the folks whom I was interviewing, which included at that moment the leader and essentially the vice president of the CCP, the Peasant Confederation, they had no idea who I was talking about. They had never heard of Yamoja. And it really struck me at that point that the way to understand how Yamoja characterized himself in these sometimes seemingly egotistical statements were very much a corrective to sort of bring back and amplify the work that he had done that had for, you know, by both design and accident been essentially erased from, or not erased, but minimized in sort of the narrative of Peruvian history and certainly historiography. But the title itself was one that I came up with. When I suggested it to him, he laughed and he thought that was great.
I'm happy to hear that. It strikes me also that this kind of his ambition or the concern that this might be arrogance also comes about in a context in which indigenous people in Peru particularly are not assumed to have this kind of national scope or this kind of large ambition. And so part of his story is that he is so is that he really puts a lie to those sort of stereotypes about indigenous people.
For sure. And, you know, I think this was one of the things that was so striking to me about Yamoja from the very first encounter with him in the archive when it was Yamoja on paper, was that, you know, I had the framework of Peruvian history in my head that I'd learned from books written by, you know, really fabulous historians that said, and social scientists that said, you know, in Peru, the campesino identity or the peasant identity is at the forefront because the severity of racism in Peru means that indigenous identity among Quechua peoples like Yamoja has just been, you know, consciously repressed and silenced as a way of allowing sort of a conscious choice in many ways by peasants to reject indigenous identity as a way of, you know, integrating themselves into a nation state in which anti-indigenous racism was so virulent and so pressing. And, you know, for the most part, there's that explanatory line is mostly correct. But then here was Yamoja in the 1960s talking about colonialism and talking about being proudly indigenous and talking about being, you know, in his words, like a fierce son of the Indian race, while also at the same time using this language of campesino. And he was unusual in that respect. And, you know, very innovative. And you know, what you've suggested here is exactly right. I mean, in Peru, there was a certain life course expected for peasants from indigenous backgrounds. And that was not to be president. That was not even to be a priest. You know, one of the first things he wanted to do was to be a Catholic priest. And he went and tried to, you know, get himself essentially in training. And he was dismissed precisely because it was like, you're an indigenous peasant. Like, what are you doing? It was sort of the reaction that he received. And so very much him saying, now Peru is mine, making these grand plans, was him saying, you know, as an indigenous peasant, I know Peru better than those who aren't. And I, you know, this is who I am, is an asset. And it's something to be proud of. And, you know, he never silenced who he was. And he never embraced a strictly class-based identity, but he also never rejected that class-based identity. I mean, he very much saw himself as a campesino, but the way that he defined Campesino was as somebody of Quechua origins, and those Quechua origins linking back to the time of the Inca. And that did not sit well with a lot of the leftists of the 1970s, who thought that indigenous identity was retrograde, was that race itself was this tool to divide the working class, and that any focus on indigenous identity just worked to the benefit of the oppressors, and that we had to think in sort of strictly Marxist, strictly classist terms. And he refused, and he caught a lot of grief for that. One document that I found was a criticism of him written by someone in the Shining Path. It wasn't clear who wrote it. And they dismissed him as that guy with the Incaic ideas. Like, he's irrelevant. He's, lost in this sort of great Inca vision and only wants to talk about, the Inca past. And it was a struggle for him to maintain that identity in its full complexity. And even in his own family, he had a complex family relationship with his brothers and sisters. And one of his sisters in particular, refused to think of herself as indigenous. And they got into really harsh arguments about whether or not their family was indigenous or not.
And that's such an interesting story for thinking about the ways that that these identities function together and on a very intimate scale. His story is so good for showing that. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about his relationship to the Shining Path, because I know it comes up again and again in both your research into his actions and also his life course. I mean, his life is affected by the accusations that fly at him kind of from both sides. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what his story tells us about the Shining Path and also his relationship to it.
Sure. So, I'll start with what we assumed about Yomocha, which is that sort of the first book that came out about the Shining Path that really cracked open what this organization, this party was a very famous book by, an outstanding book in almost every respect, by a journalist named Gustavo Goriti. At the time he was a journalist for Peru's major news magazine, a news magazine called Caretas. And he had done some of the earliest reporting on what was happening in Peru's Andean regions. The civil war broke out in 1980, and for the most part, it was confined in those early months and early years to the indigenous rural regions in the Highland Sierra. And so Lima, which was the center of power, the coast, wasn't paying a lot of attention to what was going on, to the suffering that was already taking place. And Goriti was, a Lima journalist, but he went. He went to Ayacucho. He was really instrumental in getting the country and to an extent the world to pay attention to, the incredible violence that was being unleashed both by the Shining Path and the very devastating state counterinsurgency. And so he publishes this book in 1991 or 1992 called Sendero. And it was just a path-breaking book. It helped us understand really for the first time in a great deal of clarity what the Shining Path is about. And he talks about Yomocha in a single sentence in the book. And he said in that book, he said that there had been a meeting in the home, in the Ayacucho home of Shining Path activist Manuel Yomocha. And a lot of people, if they had heard of Yomocha, thought back to that line. That's where they were introduced to Yomocha. I thought Yomocha had been in Shining Path because of that line. And also because Yomocha had certainly been very closely affiliated with the Maoist side of the Peruvian left since the 1960s. So there's that one part of the story, sort of that one line in Goriti's book. Now, where that line came from, it's hard to know. I've not interviewed Goriti. But, Manuel Yomocha, the reason that he was able to rise to such prominence so quickly in the 1960s was because he worked very, very closely with a guy named Saturnino Paredes. And Paredes was essentially the head of Peru's Maoists. When Peru's left split into Stalinist and Maoist factions in the early 1960s, Paredes was essentially the lead Maoist, and he and Yamoja worked very closely together. And so there's no question that Yamoja agreed with Maoism, that Yamoja was inspired by Maoism, that Yamoja worked very, very closely with Maoists. He went to China in 1965, did a tour. He would have stayed for longer had he not fallen very ill. But Yamoja himself never explicitly joined the Maoist Peruvian political party, at least not so far as I can tell. He and I talked about this over and over again. It was sort of the one area of his life where his stories were always kind of frustratingly vague, in that the most he would ever say was that he sympathized with Maoism, but that he didn't give it his whole heart. And at the end of the day, you know, it's his story. And so I chose to sort of try to present that without saying, you know, without presuming that he was more involved than he said he was. So certainly we can say he worked with Maoists, he sympathized with Maoists, he went to China, and he very much collaborated with Maoists, but he never, at least in our stories or in our interviews, he never went so far as to say, I'm a Maoist. And certainly nothing he wrote did he ever explicitly say, I'm a Maoist. Nonetheless, in Peru, to this day, you say Mao or Maoism or work with Maoist, and you're immediately assumed to be a member of Shining Path. And so when the Shining Path's first attacks in Peru, its first uprising or its sort of first efforts began, Yamoja was very quickly assumed to be part of those attacks and those efforts. There are two additional complicating factors. He knew the founder of Shining Path, Abimael Guzman. They had met. They had tried to work together. It didn't really last. Guzman was not particularly interested in hearing all of Yamoja's stories and following all of his advice. But that sort of momentary affiliation between the two men, that momentary collaboration, particularly in relation to one hacienda that Yamoja had long fought against, that was enough to essentially link Yamoja with Shining Path in the minds of authorities and certainly in the minds of his enemies. And so Yamoja was very quickly accused of being a mastermind of Shining Path, even though he was no such thing. And that those accusations of terrorism, essentially, the word terrorist was used against him very explicitly by his enemies, accusing him of being part of Shining Path, of carrying out terrorist violence. Those accusations forced him to flee from his home, flee from Ayacucho, and to live essentially in hiding for 20 years in Lima as an internal refugee, along with hundreds of thousands of other Peruvians living as internal refugees. So that's one other component of the story of how Shining Path and Yamoja's stories intersect. The third and ultimately most devastating connection between Yamoja and Shining Path involves his children. His oldest son was accused of being in Shining Path and was imprisoned for this, and he was actually released just days before a terrible massacre of Shining Path activists occurred in the particular jail in which he was held. His oldest daughter was likewise accused of being in Shining Path and was likewise imprisoned. His second oldest daughter was accused. She was interrogated. She was not, to my knowledge, imprisoned. And his youngest daughter was likewise forced to flee from Ayacucho with an assumed identity to live in safety in Lima. but it's the story of his youngest son, a young man named Herbert, where this question of affiliation with Shining Path was most devastating. One of Shining Path's first and most prominent attacks, armed actions, was on an hacienda called Airabamba, which was an hacienda, Airabamba, that had long been in conflict with Yamaha's home community of Concepcion. And Herbert, as Yamaha's youngest son, was very much sort of following in his dad's footsteps. He was very much committed to social justice. He was very much committed to doing all he could to fight against injustice. He was very much committed to doing the kind of work his dad had. And Herbert participated in that attack on Airabamba. That's clear. Whether or not he was actively affiliated with Shining Path is not 100% clear. He probably was. The book doesn't sort of explicitly go there, although it hints at it. And that's all we can do. You know, I don't have definitive proof that Herbert was in Shining Path. It doesn't really matter. He certainly worked with the Shining Path. And because of his participation in that attack, he was flagged in the minds of local authorities as being involved in Shining Path. And quite tragically, he was also flagged within Yamaha's own family by Yamaha's brother, so Herbert's uncle. So Herbert's uncle essentially snitched on Herbert, revealed to the authorities where Herbert was, stated that he was involved, and led the authorities to his nephew, to Yamaha's son. So Yamaha's son was seized by the authorities. He was taken from Yamaha's house, and he was placed under arrest. He was placed under arrest and put in one jail, then with some Shining Path activists, transferred later to another jail with some Shining Path activists. From that jail, he wrote some really beautiful letters and petitions. He was an incredible guy, a lot like his dad. And then Shining Path activists attacked that jail where Herbert was held with the goal of freeing the Shining Path militants who were imprisoned in that jail. There were others imprisoned in that jail, so it wasn't just Shining Path activists, but Herbert was one of the people in that jail when the Shining Path attacked. And that's essentially where Herbert's story ends. We don't know what happened to him. It's possible that he was killed by the police in the shootout that happened around that jailbreak. It's possible that he escaped from that jail and then lost his life elsewhere. We simply don't know. So he, Herbert disappeared. And that disappearance, that the fact that to this day the family doesn't know what happened to Herbert, that was really the central tragedy of Manuel Yamaha's life. And that's a tragedy that is sort of fundamentally linked in complicated ways to the Shining Path's war and the state counterinsurgency against that war.
It's a really tragic story, and one that is, you know, not unfortunately unique in the history of Peru. What is maybe the most unique about Yamaha and Herbert's story is how many things Yamaha was really central to, how many important national events in the late 20th century. But that this sort of relationship between trying to participate in movements that might help your community, might help your family, or might help the nation, and the tension between those and the escalation of violence that was happening in that time and place, just the sort of silence in Herbert's story particularly speaks, I think, huge amounts to the tragedy of what was happening in Peru at the time.
Sure. And I should add that, you know, when Yamaha and I spoke about Shining Path and spoke about Guzman, Yamaha was very clear that while Guzman and Shining Path might have had some good ideas at the start about, you know, revolution and changing Peru, that their methods were something that he absolutely could not agree with. You know, Yomoja in our interviews was adamant that the Shining Path strategy of essentially killing peasant leaders and killing those with whom it disagreed was appalling and something that he would never, ever condone. He was also very explicit about the fact that he had never held a gun. Sometimes he laughed when he would tell this story about, like, oh man, if I'd only picked up a machine gun at an earlier point in my life, like, who knows what amazing things might have happened. But he was very clear that he had never been involved in fighting. And he was also very explicit in the fact that he rejected the extreme violence of the Shining Path. At the same time that he was also extraordinarily critical of the state's counterinsurgency. You know, often the way things worked out in Peru is that you were sort of the sort of framework of you're with us or against us would hold. That if you were criticizing the state's counterinsurgency, that must mean you were an apologist for the Shining Path or a supporter of the Shining Path. And Yomoja was quite frankly, you know, gave lie to that incorrect assertion. You know, he was, you know, ready and willing to denounce both the Shining Path's violence, but also the horrors of the state's counterinsurgency.
His story is such an important addition to and sort of corrective to the way many people think about or the way the story could be told about the Shining Path. Well, so I guess one last major question for you, which is just, what advice would you have to someone who might want to take on a project like this in the future? You start off with the advice, don't assume someone is dead. And maybe your second bit of advice would be pick an amazing subject, but.
You know, I would say that, you know, I took heart from Yomoja's amazing determination. I mean, this book faced so many obstacles. The most tragic obstacle was, you know, one of the earliest, and that, you know, when I finally was informed that he was alive and, you know, went to Peru and met him and we had our first interviews and sort of we made this plan for this book. We spent a couple of days together recording and just getting to know each other. I left Concepcion, I left his home community, went back to Ayacucho to spend a little bit more time in the archives. And about a week after our first interviews were over, I got a phone call from his daughter. Well, actually, no, the phone call was from my friend Ricardo. Actually, I'm sorry, this is going to have to be erased because I can't remember who phoned me. Somebody phoned me and told me that just out of nowhere, Yomoja's just beloved wife, this really cool, super strong woman. Her name was Doña Esther. She had died. She had an aneurysm that no one saw coming. She was 10 years younger than Yomoja, way healthier, way more energetic. You just never would have guessed that in that couple that she would be the first to go. And so tragedy struck, and this was just not the moment to do more interviews. I sort of always tell my students, my grad students, like, compassion and humanity matters way more than our work as historians. Like, that is what you prioritize in an interview. That is what you prioritize in a project, being compassionate and humane. And the compassionate and humane thing to do at that point in time was not to try to get more interview materials. It was to, you know, provide what comfort I could to the family and also respect that, you know, we didn't have, as a family, sort of me and the family, we didn't have a strong relationship at that point. And the thing to do really was to simply allow the family to grieve. And yet, in my continuing correspondence with, you know, Yomoja didn't have email, but his daughter Maria, who lives in Lima, she certainly did. You know, he wanted this project to continue. And so finding ways to keep going, if that's what the person you're working with wants, was essential. And for this project, the way that we found forward, when I couldn't stay in Peru indefinitely, I had my family, I had my job, I couldn't stay in Peru for sort of months on end, was to hire a research assistant. This was my friend and longtime research assistant, a woman named Alicia Carrasco. We'd worked together before. She had met Yamoha with me. You know, I hired her to continue interviewing Yamoha with interview questions that I emailed her from Canada. And I felt horrible about this methodology. Like, the anthropologist in me just screamed that this was absolutely not the way to do oral history interviews. Like, oral history interviews by proxy just struck me as completely unacceptable. But there was Yamoha saying, we've got to get this done. I'm old. I'm losing my memory. I'm not going to remember. I want to talk. I want to get these stories recorded. And so, you know, I chose to go with that and to use this utterly imperfect, incredibly problematic methodology of oral history by proxy. And Alicia, you know, she's not a historian. She's a social worker. And she would, you know, in the interviews, she would just read my interview questions one by one and let Yamoha talk. I mean, these were not sort of the kind of interviews that I would, you know, celebrate. You know, this is not a methodology that I would recommend. And yet this was what Yamoha wanted. And this ultimately was what worked. Ironically, I think I got so much from those interviews. And Alicia also did amazing work in interviewing Yamoha's siblings, essentially crossing Peru to find different members of his family, different sort of colleagues, friends, people who knew him, interviewing them again, all with these interview questions that I emailed. And then she would send back the transcripts over Dropbox. She would do a first draft of transcribing. I would retranscribe and then send follow-up questions. And what that meant was that by the time I came back to Peru the following summer to meet with Yamoha again, we could just hit the ground like 4,000 kilometers ahead of where we had been and take up essentially all of these questions once again. I already had a draft of the book that I'd translated into Spanish. And we basically re-recorded, he and I, all of those stories because he wanted to share them again. And so all this time that I'd been feeling just horrible about this methodology that seemed so imperfect, that seemed so clunky and problematic and so far from ideal, that ended up being what worked for us. And, you know, I sort of came to the conclusion from things Yamoha told me that, you know, imperfect and done is better than perfect and never, ever completed. And, you know, Yamoha was elderly and he was losing his memory and he didn't ultimately get to see the book published. He died just a few months before the book was out, but he did get to see the full and complete draft. He saw that draft translated into Spanish. He helped me choose the cover. You know, he got to make the dedication and had we not pursued that, you know, completely terrible, like not acceptable anthropological method of sort of the perfect oral history interview setup, the project probably would never have been finished. And so ultimately, this is my long way of saying my advice is be pragmatic, and things that can seem like real sacrifices for the perfection of a project, if they let that project get done and it's done in a way that the person you're working with, your co-author, your collaborator likes and is happy with, then, you know, don't worry about what you presume perfect anthropology or perfect history has to be.
That's such a helpful way of thinking about taking on projects like this and really foregrounding the idea that he was taking control of that process by saying, I want to do this now. And his needs were not on like when you could get back to Peru, for example. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for this fascinating conversation. And thank you for the book. I really enjoyed reading it and my students enjoyed talking about it.
I'm so glad. I know Yamoha would be thrilled.
It's a shame that we couldn't bring this back to him somehow, but but it's a good, wonderful testament to his life as well. So thank you so much. And
no, it was great. It was delightful. Thank you so much for the opportunity.